The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We've had a really, last couple of months, we've had a pretty decent stream of new listeners to the show. So welcome to everybody who is just arriving. This is the standard in learning anything and everything you want to know about the Bitcoin system. So congratulations on making your way here. With that though, today is going to be a great day for exactly that. One of the most important things to wrap your head around in order to understand Bitcoin isn't actually related to Bitcoin, or is not directly about Bitcoin. It's about how the dollar works. It's about how fiat money works, and more importantly, what its consequences are and what happens when it stops working. You have to understand our money as it is now. Only when you see all of the trade-offs and significant problems of the fiat monetary systems can you then see the revolutionary elements of Bitcoin. It makes it so much more clear that the fundamental trust problems, the corruption, and the subjective nature of fiat is either completely solved or simply made obsolete by the Bitcoin monetary system. And that is what we are digging into today and probably tomorrow because it is a beast. We have got another great piece from Lynn Alden. She's had a couple of really great pieces about Bitcoin, and her investment blog and kind of macroeconomic breakdowns are just really, really good recently. And this one is definitely a must read or must listen. All right, a quick thank you to our awesome sponsors for the podcast today before we dive into the piece. For your Bitcoin banking services and a free exchange with no fees, we have the amazing Levvl.co. That's LVL.co. They're in 28 states across the US and counting. Then we have the standard in Bitcoin security for your savings, an open source and easy to use hardware wallet. That is the Bitbox O2. Honestly, out of the seven that I have so far, it's really, in my opinion, the best for somebody new to the space. And then lastly, for a mobile solution to holding your own keys, we have the Hexa Wallet. Multiple accounts, it's privacy preserving, two-factor, transaction batching, custom fees, just tons of great features, and they are still in beta, so many updates and new features to come. You can check out all three of our awesome sponsors at guyswan.com. All right, now, as we get into it, if there are some terms or maybe some ideas that are foreign or confusing, I'm going to try to break it down a little simpler in the Guy's Take section at the end of the show. So if you ever feel lost, don't worry, we will be coming back and covering the main concepts again. But without further ado, let's get into Lynn Alden's amazing piece, The Fraying of the U.S. Global Currency Reserve System. Since autumn of 2019, I have been bearish on the dollar, meaning I have a longish-term outlook towards a weaker dollar. This view began forming when the Federal Reserve cut interest rates in the summer of 2019. And then the view solidified with a catalyst after an overnight repo rate spike in September 2019 forced the Fed to begin supplying repo liquidity. In my October 2, 2019 article titled "The Most Crowded Trade," I said to look for a weaker dollar in 2020 and also stated that the Fed would likely start expanding its balance sheet by buying treasuries in 2020 or perhaps as early as that quarter in 2019 due to oversupply. Days later, the Fed indeed announced that they will begin buying treasuries, and as of this writing, well over a year later, they haven't stopped. Here's the dollar index since my October article, having fallen from about 99 to 92. Going forward, over the next 3 to 5 years, I still expect many currencies, including the dollar, to continue to devalue versus hard assets, and for the dollar to probably be among the weaker major currencies during that time frame, with occasional counter rallies against that trend, as is natural. While it may or may not continue to be, so far this view has been correct. The dollar index is weaker now than it was in October 2019, but it's still a process playing out. We had a curveball to the outlook from the pandemic in the first half of 2020 that temporarily spiked the dollar. But that merely added massive volatility to the structural forces playing out, rather than changing their direction. I don't have a firm opinion about the next 3 to 6 months, because there are plenty of solvency issues between now and when things might start normalizing in the spring or summer of 2021. And the dollar shorts are getting crowded at the moment. But as we look into late 2021 and into 2022, I remain with a dollar bearish outlook. Taking my view a step further, evidence shows that the global monetary system as currently structured is gradually realigning itself. And this fact will have important ramifications for investments over the long run. This article explores some of those concepts, ranging from the fraying of the existing petrodollar system for all its stakeholders, both for U.S. interests and foreign interests, to central bank digital currencies, to a total restructuring of the global monetary system. It's inherently a challenging subject, because for decades there have been many unsophisticated calls for a, quote, dollar collapse, always right around the corner, that never materialize. However, this isn't one of those calls. It's a quantitative look at the nearly 50-year history of this current global monetary system as structured since the early 1970s. This article places an emphasis on where the bottlenecks and problems have been forming in the system, explains why a continued weak dollar over a 3 to 5 year period remains my base case, and shows why some of these growing pains seem to be leading to a new reordering of the global monetary system over this decade. Part 1. The structure of the global monetary system. Rather than being a haphazard mess, international trade and exchange rates have a certain structure to them, built and enforced by the hegemonic powers that exist during a given era. In other words, at any given time, an empire or set of powerful countries work together to enforce a rules-based global order on how international trade works and how it is priced. However, there is inherently an economic entropy within any system, as order gradually frays into disorder. Global monetary systems can be long-lasting, but not permanent. As the global center of power shifts over time, and as bottlenecks and imperfections in the system grow to unsustainable levels, resulting in increasing levels of disorder, a system gradually or abruptly gets reordered into another system. Ironically, it is often not an external threat that brings down the existing order. It's the flaws within the system that, left unchecked, eventually expand enough to bring it down and necessitate a reordering, either from the same ruling regime or from a new regime that displaces it. Over the past century, for example, the world went from a gold standard system to the Bretton Woods system to the petrodollar system. Each system mostly unraveled from within rather than being brought down externally, and each time one system transitioned to another, a significant and widespread currency devaluation occurred. The gold standard, pre-1944. For much of human existence, economies were based on trade. Furs for oysters, olive oil for spices, labor for bread, etc. The mining of precious metals like gold and silver made that simpler, and these metals have been considered money for thousands of years. With precious metals, you could turn a specific commodity, like furs, into a universal commodity, like gold and silver, which are rare, long-lasting, and able to be broken into small, measurable units to buy whatever you want at a later date. From there, paper currency and credit was added as a more convenient layer onto gold. Gold itself could be held securely in vaults, and paper slips representing a share of that gold could be used as mediums of exchange. Sometimes they were issued by private banks, and in modern times they were generally issued by sovereign governments. In this sense, governments would issue paper currency that is backed by gold held in central bank vaults. From that point, we saw the rise of global reserve currencies, referring to either paper or precious metal currencies of trading or military empires that were recognized and accepted in many countries outside their own homeland. The Roman Empire was an ancient example. More recently, the Dutch Empire was a notable example, followed by the United Kingdom and now the United States. In the 1800s and early 1900s, the United Kingdom had the mantle of the most globally recognized currency, although it existed within a system of many currencies being backed by gold. During these centuries, the center of global power mostly rested within Europe, with its precise epicenter shifting over time, and wars within Europe played a large role in its eventual replacement. Under this gold standard system, exchange rates between currencies still shifted over time for various reasons, with the balance of payments being a key variable. My article, titled "Why Trade Deficits Matter," goes into detail on why that is the case. The crux of it is that whenever a country began persistently importing more than it was exporting, it risked having gold flow out of the country and risked economic stagnation within the homeland. Ultimately, however, this state would usually be self-correcting because a recession would eventually devalue the currency, which would make their exports more competitive and imports more expensive, and thus realign their export and import balance. In the later stages of this system, all major nations devalued their currencies sharply and reset or suspended their gold pegs. The winners of the world wars devalued their currencies less than the losers, but everyone devalued. This was partly from the wars, but also just as much from the end of the long-term debt cycle. The Bretton Woods system, from 1944 to 1971. The most recent handover of global reserve currency status gradually began after World War I and was finalized in the later stages of World War II. As a result of the wars and the rise of the American economy, the center of global power shifted from Europe, and particularly the United Kingdom, to the United States. In the 1930s, the United States government made gold ownership illegal and forced citizens to sell their gold to the government, which allowed the government to build up huge gold reserves. Then, in order to keep gold safe during the war, many countries shipped their gold to the United States. So, the United States had its own massive gold stockpile and also served as the global gold custodian for many allies. As World War II unfolded, while Europe and East Asia were devastated by the war, the United States' homeland was barely touched, and the U.S. became the world's largest creditor nation in the process. At that point, the Bretton Woods system was established, whereby the United States backed its dollar by gold, and dozens of other countries pegged their currencies to the dollar, and thus also had a gold standard by association. Many countries held U.S. treasuries as a form of reserve collateral that was, quote, as good as gold. The dollar was not redeemable to U.S. citizens for gold, but it was redeemable to foreign governments for gold. During this time, the United States also began laying the groundwork for its alliance with Saudi Arabia, which would come into play with the next system. This period also saw the rise of the euro-dollar market, referring to the dollar market that exists between banks and other entities outside of the United States and outside of the Federal Reserve's jurisdiction, primarily centered in Europe but extending throughout the world. With the Bretton Woods system and the following petrodollar system, the United States obtained a near-global lock on the international money system. Previous empire currencies never obtained that complete of a financial lock on the world, and thus were never true global reserve currencies, but instead were just widely recognized and dominant currencies. So the 1944 to present status of the dollar as the global reserve currency is not perfectly comparable to pre-1944 periods of other global reserve currencies. This period was rather unique, in other words. It was the first time technology allowed the entire world to be connected together enough for a truly global war to happen, and for a truly global monetary system to come in its wake. However, after only a decade, the Bretton Woods system began to fray. The United States began running large fiscal deficits and experiencing mildly rising inflation levels, first for the late 1960s domestic programs, and then for the Vietnam War. The United States began to see its gold reserves shrink, as other countries began to doubt the backing of the dollar, and therefore redeem dollars for gold instead of comfortably holding dollars. This chart shows U.S. gold reserves as measured in metric tons. Now, real quick, there are a lot of charts and graphics in this piece to kind of demonstrate the ideas that she's trying to get across, and I definitely encourage you to go to the link in the show notes to actually look at these so that you can kind of get a view of what's happening. But just to get a general idea, this just shows the incredible growth in the gold reserves that this country had during the establishment of the dollar standard in the Bretton Woods system, and then it dropping by more than half just over the period of the 60s, and then finally completely leveling off as soon as the Bretton Woods system ended. All right, let's jump back in. In fact, the numbers show that from inception, it was already on an unstable path. The U.S. began the system with more gold than foreign liabilities, but that gap quickly began closing within the first few years. By the late 1950s, U.S. external liabilities exceeded U.S. gold reserves. By the mid-1960s, the subset of U.S. external liabilities that were owed to foreign officials exceeded U.S. gold reserves, which was the true crossover point where the system became troubled. And by 1971, the system broke down and was defaulted on by the United States. The system had an underlying flaw that, when left unaddressed, brought that system down. It was never truly sustainable as designed. There was no way that the U.S. could maintain enough gold to back all of its currency for domestic use and simultaneously back enough currency for expanding global use as well, which was the part that was redeemable. Some economists, such as Robert Trifon, explicitly warned about this problem to Congress and the business world in what became known as the Trifon Dilemma. It was a foreseeable problem, in other words. The same thing happened to the United Kingdom in the early 1900s, prior to World War I. John Keynes saw the problem ahead of time, too, and proposed an alternate system called the Bancor, where an international unit of account based on gold and a basket of major currencies would be used to settle balances of trade and would be held as a central bank reserve asset. This would be an inherently more balanced system with a neutral settlement mechanism rather than centering everything on the currency of one country. However, politics often wins out over math, at least at first, and the Bretton Woods system won over the other ideas. Something like the Bancor idea was enacted on the side by the IMF as well, with units called SDRs that are a basket of major currencies and are still held by central banks, but it never had enough support to catch on in more than a limited way. Eventually, in 1971, math came back with a vengeance on the Bretton Woods system, and Richard Nixon ended the convertibility of dollars to gold, and thus ended the Bretton Woods system. The closing of gold convertibility was proposed to be temporary at the time, but it ultimately became permanent. Rather than shifting to another country, though, the United States was able to reorder the global monetary system with itself still in its center in the next system. Ultimately, all major currencies, including the dollar, devalued radically versus gold and other hard assets in the 1970s. This continued the trend of major currency devaluations happening whenever the global monetary system gets reordered. Usually the same forces that break the system also break the currency itself. When that happens, the quantity of broad money supply goes up significantly, and the purchasing power of existing debts gets partially inflated away. The petrodollar system, 1974 to present. Beginning in 1971, after the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system, currencies around the world all became fiat currencies, and the global monetary system became less ordered. This was the first time in human history that this happened, where all currencies in the world at the same time were rendered into unbacked paper. A quote, fiat is an absolute decree from a person or institution in command. Fiat currency is a monetary system whereby there is nothing of value in the currency itself. It's just paper, cheap metal coins, or digital bits of information. It has value because the government declares it to have value and that it is legal tender to pay all things, including taxes. A country can enforce the usage of a fiat currency as a medium of exchange and unit of account within their country by making all taxes payable only in that currency, or by enacting other laws to add friction to, or in some cases outright ban, other mediums of exchange and units of account. If their currency has a big enough problem, though, as is the case for many emerging markets, a black market will develop for other mediums of exchange, such as foreign currency or hard assets. A fiat currency can face particular problems when trying to be used outside of its home country. Why should businesses and governments in other countries accept pieces of paper which can be printed endlessly by a foreign government and have no firm backing, as a form of payment for their valuable goods and services? Without a real backing, what is it worth? Why would you sell oil to foreigners for paper? In the early 1970s, there were a variety of geopolitical conflicts, including the Yom Kippur War and the OPEC oil embargo. In 1974, however, the United States and Saudi Arabia reached an agreement, and from there, the world was set on the petrodollar system, a clever way to make a global fiat currency system work decently enough. We think of this as normal now, but this five-decade period of global fiat currency is unusual and unique in the historical sense. Imagine trying to architect a way to make an all-fiat currency system work on the global stage for the first time in human history. In doing so, you have to somehow convince or force the whole world to trade valuable things for foreign pieces of paper with no guarantee from the paper-issuing governments that those papers are worth anything in particular in relation to an amount of gold or other hard assets. With the petrodollar system, Saudi Arabia and other countries in OPEC sell their oil exclusively in dollars in exchange for U.S. protection and cooperation. Even if France wants to buy oil from Saudi Arabia, for example, they do so in dollars. Any country that wants oil needs to be able to get dollars to pay for it, either by earning them or exchanging their currency for them. So non-oil-producing countries also sell many of their exports in dollars, even though the dollar is completely fiat foreign paper, so that they can get dollars for which to buy oil from oil-producing countries. And all of these countries store excess dollars as foreign exchange reserves, which they mostly put into U.S. treasuries to earn some interest. In return, the United States uses its unrivaled Blue Water Navy to protect global shipping lanes and preserve the geopolitical status quo, with military action or the threat thereof as needed. In addition, the United States basically has to run persistent trade deficits with the rest of the world to get enough dollars out into the international system. Many of those dollars, however, get recycled into buying U.S. treasuries and stored as foreign exchange reserves, meaning that a large portion of U.S. federal deficits are financed by foreign governments compared to other developed nations that mostly rely on domestic financing. This article, link included, explains why foreign financing can feel great while it's happening. The petrodollar system is creative, because it was one of the few ways to make everyone in the world accept foreign paper for tangible goods and services. Oil producers get protection and order in exchange for putting their oil in dollars and putting their reserves into treasuries. And non-oil producers need oil, and thus need dollars so they can get that oil. This leads to a disproportionate amount of global trade occurring in dollars relative to the size of the U.S. economy, and in some ways means that the dollar is backed by oil, without being explicitly pegged to oil at a defined ratio. The system gives the dollar a persistent global demand from around the world, while other fiat currencies are mostly just used internally in their own countries. This chart is 2 years old, but things haven't changed much since then. What it shows is that even though the United States represented only about 11% of global trade and 24% of global GDP in early 2018, the dollar's share of global economic activity was far higher, at 40 to 60%, depending on what metric you look at. And this gap represents its status as the global reserve currency and the key currency for global energy pricing. The inherent flaw of the petrodollar system, much like the inherent flaw with the Bretton Woods system, is that, as previously mentioned, the United States needs to run persistent trade deficits and is another version of the Trifon dilemma again. This can work for decades, but it can't work forever. Instead of drawing down our gold reserves, however, we gradually draw down our domestic manufacturing base, and it gets replaced piece by piece in foreign countries. When most other countries run trade deficits, they eventually have a big enough currency devaluation so that their exports become more competitive and importing becomes more expensive, which usually prevents multi-decade extremes from building up. However, because the petrodollar system creates persistent international demand for the dollar, it means the U.S. trade deficit never is allowed to correct and balance itself out. The trade deficit is held open persistently by the structure of the global monetary system, which creates a permanent imbalance, and is the flaw that eventually, after a long enough timeline, brings the system down. The other flaw in the system is that it incentivizes mercantilism. This means it incentivizes various trade partners to maximize their exports and minimize their imports by manipulating their currencies to weak levels. Since currencies around the world are fiat with floating exchange rates, many countries try to keep their own currencies weak so that they have a positive trade balance with the United States and other trading partners. They don't want their currencies to be so weak that their citizens can't import things, but they want their currencies to be weak enough so that their exports are very competitive and the importing power is not very strong, so that they can run trade surpluses. This allows a country to rapidly build up industrial production and accumulate dollars and reserves. As the global reserve currency, the United States is basically excluded from this option, so we are the ones left holding the bag of persistent trade deficits. Some of us, particularly near the top of the income ladder, directly or indirectly benefit from this system. Americans who work around finance, government, healthcare, and technology get many of the benefits of living in the hegemonic power, without the drawbacks. On the other hand, Americans who make physical products tend not to benefit, because they lost their jobs or had their incomes suppressed and thus haven't benefited from the gains. And outside of the United States, exporting countries benefit from the system, while countries that don't like how the global monetary system is structured don't have much recourse to do anything about it. unless they get big enough, like Russia and China. The Great Petrodollar Bull-Bear Cycle. Because exchange rates are free-floating since 1971 within the petrodollar system, the dollar can strengthen or weaken against other currencies significantly, and other currency pairs can strengthen or weaken relative to each other. Whenever the dollar begins to take a dip, we get a host of superficial articles from financial media about the potential loss of the dollar's global reserve status. But that's not how it works. Conversely, if an analyst such as myself brings up that the dollar may decrease markedly versus other major currencies, one of the comments or pushback they'll get is, "But the US is the global reserve currency." We need to treat those concepts separately. The dollar, indeed, has had two huge bear market drawdowns of 40%+ versus a basket of other major currencies within this existing monetary system, without losing global reserve currency status. Being a dollar bear within the existing petrodollar system, and having no opinion about the petrodollar system ending, is not identical to someone who thinks the petrodollar system as currently structured is coming to an end. This chart is the dollar index since the early 70s, when the petrodollar system began. The chart compares the dollar versus a basket of major currencies and shows the three major cycles it has gone through. So the chart here is just showing the US dollar value in relation to other currencies, and it shows a sharp spike in the early 80s, about 83 or 84, when basically it reached its highest point. And then it fell into a trough all the way through the 90s and then began to turn back up again towards the end of the 90s and found another peak around 2001, 2002, and then started into another cycle back down into a trough into the 2008, 2010 era, and then has kind of leveled off at what looks like another peak between 2016 and now 2020. But it's just showing these occasional peaks and troughs as it appears to continually decline overall. The dollar index broke its 50-month moving average this year, and that 50-month moving average itself now has a slight downward tilt. Could it have another one of those dollar down legs like it had after the previous two major cycle tops? Sure. So let's separate being a dollar bear from being someone who thinks the global monetary system will change structurally. The two don't necessarily go hand in hand, although they can. It's important to treat those ideas independently, because even though I do hold both of those views over different time frames, they aren't the same view. Similarly, the dollar being the world's reserve currency doesn't necessarily protect it from major swings relative to other currencies. In fact, the depth to which the dollar is plugged into the global financial system arguably gives it bigger swings than it otherwise would have, both to the upside and downside. Causes for the cycle. The dollar cycle is based on major shifts in monetary and fiscal policy, as well as the resulting capital flows for global money that wants to chase whatever area of the world is doing well. Underlying all of this is the global monetary system as currently structured, i.e., the petrodollar system. As I discussed in my February 2020 article, titled "The Global Dollar Short Squeeze," and in my April 2020 article, titled "The $40 Trillion Problem," governments and companies outside of the United States have a lot of dollar-denominated debt, $13 trillion at a minimum, according to the BIS. But also have even more dollar-denominated assets, around $42 trillion, according to the IMF and USBEA. These debts and assets were built up over decades due to those countries running trade surpluses with the United States, and from the dollar being used for the majority of global financial deals, especially for emerging markets. That dollar-denominated debt represents a consistent source of demand for dollars to service those debts. So if recessions happen, or dollar-based global trade slows down, there can become a scramble for dollars which can be in short supply outside of the United States, causing an international dollar spike. This happened in March 2020 as the pandemic sharply diminished global trade and oil prices collapsed. In that sense, the petrodollar system reinforced itself over time. At first, countries needed dollars so that they could get oil. After decades of that, with so much international financing happening in dollars, now countries need dollars so that they can service their dollar-denominated debts. So the dollar is backed by both oil and dollar-denominated debts, and it's a very strong self-reinforcing network effect. Importantly, most of those debts aren't owed to the United States, despite being denominated in dollars, but rather are owed to other countries. For example, China makes many dollar-based loans to developing countries, as do Europe and Japan. When the dollar strengthens relative to emerging market countries' local currencies, it acts as a sort of quantitative tightening for those countries because their dollar-denominated debts go up in local currency terms relative to their assets and cash flows, which can be particularly brutal during recessions. That's one of the key reasons why emerging market assets and economies are riskier and more volatile than developed market economies, their dollar-denominated borrowings. On the other hand, a weakening dollar can be like quantitative easing for them, as it eases their debt load relative to their local currency cash flows and assets. Similarly, dollar-denominated assets, especially ones held by foreign governments and central banks, acquired from years of trade and current account surpluses, represent collateral with which those countries can defend their currencies, or represent assets that they can sell in order to get dollars to support their obligations if need be. During a weak dollar period, there is often a global economic boom, and nations around the world, including the United States, have a period of growth and prosperity. If nations are smart, they start building up big foreign exchange reserves with their dollar inflows. Within this petrodollar system, that is meant buying U.S. Treasury securities. Countries also often use that period to take out dollar-based loans, which comes back to bite them later. During a strong dollar period, the global economy often slows, and nations get squeezed by dollar-denominated debts. They buy far fewer treasuries, if any, and might even sell some to get dollars to service dollar-denominated debts or manage their currency. As a result, we see a clear pattern between dollar strength and the percent of U.S. federal debt held by the foreign sector. Whenever the dollar enters one of its big bull runs, foreigners start to get squeezed. Global growth slows, including U.S. growth, due to the interconnection of the global economy, and foreigners slow down or stop their purchases of U.S. debt. This chart shows the trade-weighted dollar index in blue, with a newer index in red spliced onto it due to the fact that the longer-running index discontinued at the start of 2020, and the percent of U.S. federal debt held by the foreign sector in green. As the chart shows, each of the three major dollar index bull runs were accompanied by a sharp reduction in the percentage of U.S. federal debt held by the foreign sector. The United States was still issuing debt, but foreigners weren't buying much of it. This lack of buying by foreigners forces the U.S. to fund its own federal deficits, meaning either its private sector or increasingly the Federal Reserve itself had to buy treasuries. And that eventually leads to a dovish shift in U.S. monetary policy, which plays a role in weakening the dollar and starting the cycle anew. For a second chart, we can compare the dollar index to U.S. corporate profits, which shows that corporate profits go flat in dollar terms for a number of years every time there is one of the big dollar bull runs. In other words, as we all know, the global economy is interconnected. The U.S. usually runs into economic problems when the dollar strengthens, just like certain other parts of the world. In a strong dollar environment, U.S. exports become less competitive, and the overall global trade environment becomes sluggish, resulting in domestic stagnation within the U.S. as well. The 1980s dollar spike occurred in an environment with less global debt, so it required deliberate intervention to reverse. The second and third dollar spikes occurred in environments with more debt in the US and elsewhere, and thus were more self-correcting without global coordination by unilateral shifts in monetary policy by the US Federal Reserve to protect the US Treasury market and stimulate the domestic economy. The 1980s dollar cycle. The dollar was weak in the 1970s after going off the gold standard, and the United States and many other countries experienced rapid consumer price inflation. In the early 1980s, the new Fed chairman, Paul Volcker, jacked up interest rates to quell inflation. At the same time, Ronald Reagan ran large fiscal deficits by cutting taxes and increasing spending, which contributed to an economic boom. This combination of tight monetary policy and loose fiscal policy tends to be strong for a currency while it lasts. The first half of the 1980s saw rapid strengthening in the dollar. This contributed to the Latin American debt crisis. Emerging markets in Latin America were unable to pay dollar-denominated debts back, resulting in defaults, recessions, and currency crises. Debts within the United States were very low, so interest rates could be kept high by Volcker for a long time, which added a lot of fuel to the dollar bull run. The dollar eventually reached an apex in 1985, when the United States and four other major countries, Germany, Japan, United Kingdom, and France, agreed to deliberately weaken the dollar in an event called the Plaza Accord, so that American and European exports would be more competitive versus Japanese exports, which were dominating global trade at the time. As the dollar fell in the late 1980s and the yen strengthened markedly, money flooded into Japan, which, along with their overall strong economy, led to the massive, well-known Japanese equity and real estate bubble. The 1990s and 2000s dollar cycle. The Soviet Union fell in 1991, leaving the United States as the world's sole superpower, and led to a period of opening markets and rapid globalization. In the early 1990s, the United States had a recession and saw a period of declining interest rates, and the dollar was weak overall. Emerging markets had a strong period until the mid-1990s. At that point, the United States economy began to do well and raised interest rates, becoming the second dollar bull run. In addition, the U.S. baby boom generation reached its peak working age, resulting in the highest level of labor participation in U.S. history. By the second half of the 1990s, the United States entered a tech boom bubble period, and the dollar spiked. Several emerging markets encountered serious dollar-denominated debt problems, resulting in the 1997 Asian financial crisis and the 1998 Russian financial crisis. Emerging markets as a whole suffered. It mirrored the 1980s Latin American debt crisis, but with its epicenter in Southeast Asia. The reason that some emerging markets suffer more than others during a given cycle has to do with the amount of dollar-denominated debt that they have relative to the amount of foreign exchange reserves they have. The most vulnerable nations for a financial crisis are the emerging markets that have high dollar-denominated debts and low foreign exchange reserves, while those with the opposite situation of high reserves and low debts are well fortified. By 2000, the U.S. dot-com equity bubble began to collapse, and the Fed cut interest rates. In the years that followed throughout the 2000s decade, the dollar weakened notably, and emerging markets had a massive boom period. The acronym BRIC became popular, referring to the idea that Brazil, Russia, India, and China, due to large populations and massive growth rates, would become increasingly important on the global economic stage. The 2010s-2020s dollar cycle. The dollar remained weak for a while, although it had a brief spike around the 2008 and 9 global financial crisis as oil prices fell and a global recession occurred. The Fed in particular did 3 major rounds of quantitative easing, but those ended in late 2014. Between 2014 and 2015, as the Fed shifted to tighter monetary policy by putting an end to QE, the dollar quickly strengthened, resulting in the third major dollar bull run. Several emerging markets subsequently encountered a severe recession from 2014 to 16. In 2016, the dollar reached a peak, and there were talks of a secret Shanghai Accord to weaken the dollar, in reference to the well-known Plaza Accord of 1985. The dollar indeed weakened significantly throughout 2017, and the world encountered, quote, global synchronized growth, as it was called, where the United States, Europe, Japan, and emerging markets all did quite well together. In early 2018, the Fed began quantitative tightening, reducing the size of its balance sheet, and the dollar began re-strengthening. From peak to trough, the dollar only had a 12% drawdown from its peak, and never achieved one of those massive 40% dollar declines like the previous two cycles. By mid-2018, global growth began to slow in the US and the rest of the world. The dollar weakness was a fake-out, in other words. It was still a strong dollar period. Argentina and Turkey in particular began experiencing currency crises. They were the vulnerable ones with lots of dollar-denominated debt and little foreign exchange reserves. On the other hand, the countries that suffered in the late 1990s dollar bull run, such as Thailand, South Korea, Malaysia, and Russia, learned their lesson from last time around and came into this cycle with a ton of foreign exchange reserves and less dollar-denominated debt, which is the opposite of the situation they all had in the 1990s. They were fortified against a strong dollar this time around. By summer of 2019, the Fed began cutting interest rates in the face of slowing economic growth. In September of 2019, the overnight lending rate in the U.S. banking system spiked, leading the Fed to begin supplying repo liquidity and then eventually to buying T-bills and expanding its balance sheet, which marked the end of the quantitative tightening. This was an example of the system correcting itself, or more specifically, forcing U.S. policymakers to correct it. A strong dollar contributed to slowing global GDP growth, including in the United States, which led the Fed to cut rates. And with foreigners not buying enough treasuries for years due to the dollar being so strong, the U.S. domestic balance sheets became increasingly stuffed with treasuries and couldn't keep buying more. So the Fed had to shift from quantitatively tightening to quantitative easing, to begin buying a ton of treasuries, which floods the system with liquidity. The dollar began weakening again from there, as expected. However, the COVID-19 pandemic hit in early 2020, which halted global trade and contributed, along with a structural oil oversupply issue, to a collapse in oil prices. The dollar quickly spiked. Foreigners began outright selling treasuries and other U.S. assets to get dollars, causing the treasury market to become very illiquid and ceasing to function effectively, quote-unquote, as the Fed described it. In response to this, the Fed cut rates to zero and performed massive quantitative easing, and the U.S. federal government performed massive fiscal stimulus. The dollar began weakening again, and from there, it remains to be seen what the next chapter will be. The fraying of the petrodollar system.
Alright, let's stop there for today. Told you this thing is a beast. We are only about a third of the way through it. Let's hit our sponsor real fast, and then we will jump into Guy's take on this section. The holidays are here, and if you are like me, you have barely started shopping. And you know, at this point, if you haven't gotten every single person in your family a BitBox, then really you have already failed the Bitcoiner purity test. But there is a last minute way to save your ass. The guys at Shift Crypto just released a bundle package that includes a copy of the Little Bitcoin book at no extra charge. So it's like an all-in-one package for your easy-to-use, secure, Swiss-made, minimalist BitBox Bitcoin hardware wallet, and an introduction into why Bitcoin is so important and the philosophy of freedom behind it. And take it from the guy who did the audiobook for that one, that book is literally fire. You can check it out at the shop by going to my link at guyswan.com. It's right there on the front page. Or you can just type in the full redirect at guyswan.com/bitbox. And you can make someone very happy this holiday season with the BitBox Holiday Package. You know, probably one of the most eye-opening things to somebody who maybe is just getting into Bitcoin or taking a first look at the monetary system, and at least for me, like in my kind of journey, it's what I've learned and kind of discovered about the monetary system is just how foreign a lot of these concepts are. That, you know, you go through 20 years of schooling and literally can't give the first semblance of details as to how our monetary system works, how it is that the money that we use every day, that we save in, that we organize our lives around, that we make career choices over, that is critical to achieving all of our dreams and goals, that we could know absolutely nothing about how it works, that we could go through all of history and learn thousands of dates and kings and presidents and wars and all this crap and not know the three or four major shifts that our monetary system has been through throughout the United States and how massive those changes have been, how critically important they have been for the success and or the failures of the U.S. economy and how critically important they are for making decisions about our lives, about making long-term decisions about how we should save, what our retirement should be, and literally any decent long-term choice about how we should prepare for the future. Because if the whole architecture of the system is, you know, ready to start pulling rugs from under us, like how do we, you know, how do we prepare for a future that is just dependent on decisions from U.S. policymakers, that they're pulling the strings on the economy? And one of the really interesting takeaways. So she starts out just talking, going into kind of like how she's found herself in this position or kind of holding this view on the weakening dollar and kind of how all of this began to unfold in the last couple of years. And this is something that most people don't realize, that the economic problems that we're dealing with right now with COVID, quote unquote, aren't really COVID's economic problems. I talk about this actually pretty at length in a old Guy's Take episode. It was Guy's Take 27, and it's titled Coronavirus, Bitcoin Fixes This. And this was right at the beginning of the whole COVID mess beginning to unfold. I mean, it was like back in March, I think. Yeah, it was back in March. And kind of the thing that I was getting into there was that, you know, if you're paying attention, if you're aware of how of the indicators that, you know, the economy is about to collapse or that we're about to roll into a credit crisis or that the Fed is about to have to, you know, dump money into the treasury markets and these sorts of things, then it was obvious, as Lynn Alden like points out in this piece, that back in September of 2019, something big was about to unfold, that the Fed was going to have to, the cracks were showing, essentially. So the overnight spike actually was insane. I think it was like, you know, the interest rates are like 1%, 2%, like really, really low rates that the Fed have been pushing low for quite some time. And they tried to just eke them back up during the, 2017 period, I think it was, when everything was getting strong. But even just getting them back to already heavily manipulated low rates, even trying to squeeze anything extra out of it, like it was so clear that all of this was just sitting on air, and there was no real strength in it, that it's just because we've been able to for 50 some odd years push interest rates lower and lower, like we've been in a decreasing trend. You know, like interest rates used to be 10-20%, like during like high periods, like, you know, go back to like the 80s and stuff, like they're real interest rates. Like the interest rate is the price of time. And if everybody's in debt up to their eyeballs, the interest rate should be high in a natural market, because it literally means that we don't have any capital left to lend to people because everybody's borrowed it. The only reason they can lie, the only reason they can manipulate the rates down, is because they can pretend as if there's infinite capital, because money's just an allocator of real stuff. So if you can just fudge the numbers, you can pretend that there's infinite real stuff, because the rates, because the prices are dependent on the paper, which there is infinite paper. There's not infinite real stuff. It just works to funnel all of the actual capital out of the middle class and the lower classes into the wealthy class, those that are connected to the money and get it at incredibly low interest rates, while everybody else has 20% credit card debt. Hello, Gantian effect. So the middle class and the lower class are stuck with debt and have to deal with all the paper flooding into the system, and the wealthy class, generally, gets all the actual stuff and the capital. But the thing is, when you're getting out of the last debt cycle with more debt, this is why the interest rate has to continually go down. And there's a couple of things that Lynn brings up in this piece that really kind of shed light on the natural systemic imbalance in how our system actually operates, like how this monetary system actually works, is that the entire world literally goes into recession and has problems if the U.S. government doesn't run a deficit, which essentially means that we have to endlessly go into debt. We have to constantly print more money because the actual money itself is issued as a debt, which is the fundamental math problem that does not work. There's really no way out of this. It's a race to the bottom. Essentially, all the government can do is every time we start to come out of one of these cycles is to, try to reel it back as much as they can. But it's kind of like the Bitcoin price going up. You know, it never makes it all the way back to the previous average price. You know, like it goes to this crazy all-time high and then comes back down and finds a new plateau that was like higher than the previous plateau. Well, we do that same thing with interest rates, with issuing U.S. debt and dollars into the system, except in reverse, that the interest rate is high and then it plummets and then there's a little bit of recovery back during the economic, the next boom cycle, but it never actually makes it back to the last one, and then it falls again and again and again, and now we're basically permanently at zero, and this is roughly been the case. Like the variation has been so minor as to be insignificant since the last crisis, since 2008. And something Lynn really does a good job of showing in this article is that this is a huge monetary experiment. This is something that has never, ever happened before. We've never been able to pull it off to this degree. In fact, a fully fiat system has never been sustainable. This dollar, this petrodollar system really is the first time that it's ever actually occurred. So our monetary system is really unique in all of history when you're looking at kind of the systemic operation. Starting at 1971 to 1974-ish, looking back to all of history, there's essentially always been some sort of a cap, some like resistor essentially to prevent endless debasement of the currency, and in a way that cap has been taken off, and it's kind of only sustainable because of how interconnected the global economy is now. And there's a line talking about like global monetary systems and how, you know, whatever standard essentially there was essentially a consequence of the dominant economic or military power of the time. In fact, I think I got the quote here. Quote, in other words, at any given time, an empire or set of powerful countries work together to enforce a rules-based global order on how international trade works and how it is priced, end quote. So this is really important to understand, that without some sort of international standard, without some way to set the rules of trade and agreement, That global trade is really, really difficult to sustain. Like, it ends up becoming incredibly bifurcated and separate markets that essentially don't speak the same language in a way. And that's incredibly important from a monetary perspective. And the benefit of participating to be able to speak the same economic language is massive. The ability to, it's the veritable division of labor. Like, it, that's the very idea of it. You know, if you have five people to split up the division of labor with, that's efficient, far more efficient than any than every individual having to do, like, everybody does one of five jobs, right? And they specialize, they each specialize in their own area, and then they trade, and they essentially can get five times the productivity of each individual person. Just when you're talking about the flat time spent, but then to specialize, to be able to have someone who commits all of their resources to just building the house, where somebody else commits all their resources and thinking to just fishing, or catching food or whatever it is, that even becomes another layer more efficient, because that focus allows the guy who's, you know, learning how to fish or catch food come up with additional, like, better ways and better productivity within the food industry than they would ever be able to do if they also had to deal with building their house, with making their clothes, with, you know, these other jobs that the economy has. So it's not only just a flat value and, like, efficiency and productivity boost on the fact that you're splitting up the work being done, but it's also another huge boost in the fact that each person is able to focus on one thing and specialize in something that they are particularly skilled at. You know, somebody who sucks at fishing isn't going to go do the fishing stuff. It will be the people who are specifically really good at catching food end up specializing in that through competition. And then because of that, we're all massively wealthier because we can now buy way more food with less of the housing that we build or the clothes that we make, whatever it is. And now when you start mixing economies, when you start adding new people to that system, that continues to increase in orders of magnitude. It's like Metcalfe's law, the whole network effect of a network's value is the square of the number of participants. This is true of the division of labor and the specialization of labor as well in the economy. You know, if you have five people, you know, you can split up five different jobs, but there's still going to be a lot of things that everybody is still going to have to do. You know, everybody still has to do their own laundry. Everybody still has to, you know, there's some subset of jobs and productivity that you can't offload to somebody else because there's just not enough people and enough skill within the group, within the community, to actually cover those jobs. So you double that to 10 people, to 20 people, and now you can hyper-specialize. You can get further and further down into extremely specific roles, extremely specific ideas and specializations, and where somebody can just be the one that designs new hooks for the fishing rod. Like, they don't do anything else because the industry of catching food is so efficient that now there's enough capital to actually make minute improvements that unfold feed back on themselves when now the thousands of people who are in the industry can all get a 2% boost from this tiny little thing. Suddenly that level of specialization is possible. And this is kind of what happens when you make a global economy, is suddenly when everybody's speaking the exact same monetary and kind of economic language, is that the benefit of working together is absolutely massive. And when you're combining whole populations, the level of specialization that can occur when manufacturing or skills or tech or code or whatever it is can branch across all sorts of different demographics, all sorts of different age groups and countries and perspectives and everything, that specialization just gets so much more powerful. And every new, like, cooperative unit, cooperative person in that community is another opportunity for, you know, some subtle breakthrough that just shifts everything. Bitcoin obviously being a prime example of when one mind can start putting some puzzle pieces together and just think about something uniquely and build something that just order of magnitude increases the productivity and the efficiency of anyone that is taking place within an economy. And there is nothing so fundamental as the money. And you're definitely going to want to hit the last part of Lynn Alden's piece here, just because she talks about the last section of this small book, basically. but the last bit of it is about what potentially that new system could look like that we appear to be moving into at this point. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. Go back to a little bit sidetracked there. Let's go back to the idea that, you know, the empire, that the dominant powers, a group of countries, work together to enforce those rules. And see, that's the thing, is that, like, there's a huge benefit from having a global standard, but because there's no explicit global government, there's no explicit standard, and it's a huge geopolitical problem, it just ends up being that whoever is dominant, I guess it's kind of a chicken and egg sort of problem, is that the dominant one is most likely to set the monetary rules, but then being able to set the monetary rules basically confirms or solidifies the dominance. But essentially, international trade has always been built on rules enforced by the hegemonic powers of the day. International trade is just necessarily one of those things that must rely on a trusted third party, because in a political sense, reliability is not maintained through honesty, it's maintained through power. So through all of history, essentially the dominant monetary system was run by the greatest empire or some powerful alliance that established that, and then they could control. You know, this is why, you know, wars were fought over trade routes and everything. Like, if you can establish the rules of international trade, you decide which country lives and dies. If all trade or economic communication has to go through one country, one power, well, then they've the power to cut off the lifeblood of anybody who's not playing the game to their liking. The control of the monetary system is arguably the most important power in the modern economy, but it has been for a long time. Like, the most important global power is the power to control, dictate price, or restrict global trade. And the U.S. has done an excellent job at doing that. The petrodollar system, she talks about, like, kind of these three eras. Is coming off the gold standard, which, if we dig into the fiat standard by Saif al-Din Amous, which I've read just the first chapter of, for those of you who don't know, you really should listen to that one. It's super, super great, and I'm really jacked about that book. But that basically the gold standard potentially could have failed because of a technological problem. Is that, you know, gold is a horrible settlement mechanism from an international standpoint, because it's so slow. It's incredibly hard to do business in something that is essentially 100% dependent on someone else's trust in order to do anything across political boundaries or, you know, over countries or oceans or anything like that. The only thing that you can reasonably trade are gold IOUs, which means that there is a center of power, there is a center of trust. And naturally, any incentive in that, or any set of incentives that encourages that or requires that, is going to get abused massively. If there's a center of power and a center of control, then guess what? It gets used for power and control. Like, corruption is inevitable. It's not a case of, like, oh, you find the right angels to run it. No, if you leave the vulnerability open, it gets attacked. Period. End of story. The incentives are what matters, and it doesn't matter how long you think you found the nicest people in the world to run the system. It's going to get abused. It's going to be corrupt, because that is how it's designed. But digging into the monetary system after, so first we went to the Bretton Woods Agreement post World War II. Because, you know, the U.S. came out as the dominant power, and it's really easy to, you know, we needed that monetary standard. They were the dominant, so let's just put it back on essentially a quote-unquote gold standard, but through a proxy, is that we will back all of our central banks, all of our currencies with the dollar, and the dollar will be backed by gold. Now, obviously, this is a huge central point of failure, and of course, it gets exploited, it gets corrupted, because who doesn't want to be able to go into debt at almost no cost and just basically fund whatever the hell they want? And, you know, the governments, other governments and central banks started trying to call their gold due. You know, all of these countries had IOUs, so they wanted what they were owed. And Nixon cut that off real fast, because if you saw the chart, again, I would recommend going to look at the charts that actually coincide with this, because these steep increase when we went to the dollar standard, when the Bretton Woods Agreement happened, and, you know, 1933, they outlawed gold, like the amount of gold reserves in the U.S. just took a sharp increase. The chart is actually a little bit misleading on how sharp that is. You know, look at the years, like she kind of squished a lot of the years at the beginning. But just the general idea is that, you know, there was a continual increase in the gold reserves. And then they started to level out, and then we would hit deficits and people would start calling those debts due. And then we lost like 50% of it. Like it went from, I think it was like over 20,000 metric tons down to below 10,000. And like they just basically put a halt on that. Like it was just, the gold was literally pouring out of the country at that point. And, you know, so 1971, like this was going to be the end of the U.S. Monetary policy if they didn't have any sort of a political strategy around this. And as Lynn Alden said, this was math. Like this was inevitable. Like it was never going to work like that anyway. And it didn't work very long either. It's like, what, 20 years, 30 years? That is when the petrodollar was born. And the more and more I learn about the petrodollar system, and the more I learned, like, when I first dug into it, like, so, like, my general thinking or whatever is always just, like, this is just unbelievably corrupt and, like, a massive system of control. And, you know, it's kind of always been that way, but from, you know, you go back to history, like that's, as she says, the empire is always the one setting the rules here. But what's really fascinating to me is, maniacal or not, the political brilliance of the petrodollar system is really not easy to dismiss. It really is a freaking phenomenal way to essentially force the world on the dollar. So basically what happened is the oligopoly of oil giants partnered with the U.S., the economic and military giant, and the U.S. is, you know, using their position here that that they're already the dominant Treasury Reserve assets, they're already the dominant foreign reserves. Like all of this stuff, like the dollar already has that position. Obviously, it could potentially be on its way out, but if they can hold on to that, they can still take advantage of it in the short term. And they have their military might and the economic might of the U.S. Of the U.S. economy. And so they made this agreement with Saudi Arabia that essentially said, "We will defend your interests with our military. That we will just for free, you will get protection and assistance from our military might. We will just offer it to you in an alliance, and all you have to do is basically what you're already doing. You have to keep saving in U.S. treasuries. You have to continue and only price your oil in U.S. dollars." And an example I used in one of my Guys Take episodes in the past was that if you could force everyone to have to buy Beanie Babies, like, it doesn't matter what it would be, but if you could make it so that no one could fill up their gas tank without buying Beanie Babies, you would create a massive market for Beanie Babies. Everybody, and people wouldn't just like buy just enough Beanie Babies to fill up the gas like the very next time. They would just have a trunk full of Beanie Babies at all times. Because how else am I going to fill up my gas? I need to, you know, be ready to fill up my gas at any time. So I need my Beanie Babies, right? This is essentially what they did with the dollar. They attach it to this, you know, when they say, when you hear the terms like, you know, throughout the Iraq War and like all these things, it's become much more common to hear that the U.S. is, the U.S. dollar is backed by oil. That's what it's referring to, is that you can't buy oil without having dollars. And they make damn sure of that. This is why we have been persistently at war with somebody in the Middle East for like 40 some odd years. Saudi Arabia and our interests in keeping that system afloat. So I'm sure everybody knows that, you know, the general idea that, oh, we went to the Middle East, we went to war with Iraq or whatever for oil. It's like, well, it's not like we were just trying to get like a bunch of barrels of oils, but this is what it's based on. It's a war about the money. It's about making sure that the oil only goes for dollars. You know, so when Afghanistan is building a pipeline that stretches from India to Russia so that they can trade oil outside of the petrodollar system using rubles directly between the two countries, suddenly and inexplicably, Afghanistan has deep ties to terrorism. And ironically, the most important first target is this evil new pipeline. Over and over again, this is the story of the Middle East. They are all wars over the money. It has always been about keeping the petrodollar system alive, because if the petrodollar sinks, the U.S. dominance is chained to it. So it goes to the bottom of the ocean with the petrodollar tied around its ankles. But the other really interesting thing that I did not see for a very long time about this system is that when you issue new money as debts, that it requires, that it actually fuels its own demand. And this is really something that I did not get for such a long time, was the cycle of why the dollar would get so strong during a credit crisis, like where the dollar cycle and the interest rate manipulation and the bad fiscal policy and the constant debts would fuel this huge debt bubble, and then that would reinforce the demand for the dollar when it was causing all the problems. I wasn't quite getting the key to that whole story. And Lynn Alden did a really good job of hitting it in this piece of talking about like the fact that everybody is then holding federal U.S. deficits, like U.S. debt, that they all have dollar denominated debts from the boom period in order to, you know, everybody's holding Beanie Babies, right? But they're holding Beanie Babies at interest. So when the economy goes into a downturn, suddenly they're desperate. They need those inflows. They need those exports. They need to keep pushing capital to the U.S. economy and getting dollars out. We need to keep exporting, having a bigger deficit, and just pumping paper into the whole world system, because they've got to pay the interest. They've got to pay off their debts that they are all hanging on to. So we end up financing our projects. We finance the U.S. by importing all the stuff, all the washing machines that are made in China, all the food that's grown in Mexico, all the oil that's pumped out of the Middle East. We import all the stuff and we export paper. Because if they don't buy our paper, if they don't buy our Beanie Babies, nobody can keep the lights on. They have to have them just to keep the wheels turning. But, you know, the system can't last forever. All the, you know, like she says, you know, the math can be tricked for some time, but it at some point it comes rushing back in to slap everybody in the face. And if you look at the cycles that she has on the chart, you'll notice we're in a downward trend. Same thing with the interest rates. Like there will be a point, there will be a breaking point where there's no other alternative. And as foreign countries you know, basically lower their dollar-denominated debts and, like, you know, dump this on back onto the market. And when we get more decentralized alternatives, which will be from a couple of different perspectives, which she actually gets into later on in this piece, this is where you start to see the cracks in the system. Like, eventually, this has to end. It's a feedback loop that, you know, takes steps in one direction, and there is only so far that we can go before it reels all the way back in and reality just can't be covered up anymore. So we will be getting into that with part two. All right, so before we close this episode out, a quick thank you, obviously, to our three awesome sponsors. The Hexa mobile wallet for a great non-custodial Bitcoin storage for just everyday use. We've got the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet for your cold storage for your savings. And don't forget that you can actually now get it with the Little Bitcoin Book for free, limited time only. And of course, the amazing, the not in North Carolina, and I hate it, Levl.co, LVL.co. This is full Bitcoin banking services and a no-fee exchange. And you will know the second they come to NC. You can either check them all out at guyswan.com/their respective redirects, Hexa, Bitbox, or Levl. But you can just get them right at guyswan.com, right on the front page. And I highly encourage checking them out. So don't forget to subscribe so that you don't miss the next section and the conclusion of Lynn Alden's piece. Hopefully we can do this in one episode left, but there is some really amazing gold in the rest of this piece. And we're going to look at the signals that suggest this whole petrodollar system may be reaching its end. You know, we don't really know the time frame of this, but and you know, the most fascinating thing about it all is that Bitcoin is this crazy new player that doesn't seem to fit in any of the boxes. And what the hell does the world look like, and how does this unfold with Bitcoin now in the field? And I really want to get into that in a Guy's Take episode, maybe after we complete Lynn Alden's piece. Maybe just in a standalone Guy's Take episode, because this is just such a fascinating topic to me. And like I said, the best way to understand Bitcoin, or best way to get like true insight into how powerful Bitcoin is to understand our monetary system as it is now, to understand the dollar, to understand the history of monetary systems, and how much trust they require, how much political power they instill, and how quickly they become a corrupt tool of control. And we're talking about something that has massive consequences on the scale of centuries and millennia, and that a game changer, a disruptor of the very idea, has just entered the playing field. And in my opinion, that is not something to take lightly. So don't forget to subscribe and share this with everybody you know who's making their way down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, because Bitcoin Audible is the place to learn all of it. I'm Guy Swan, and until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.